on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
He's a young, aspiring, like really on the up and up minister.
Yeah.
And he then writes a book about what their afflictions looked like, what the, and like his recommendations on how to cure them from a minister's point of view. And I think this is super, super important, where it starts what is sort of the fundamental ripple effect of Salem, which is narrative, which yeah. is the one of the big things that I play with in the book, which is the right. fact that like he writes this book, and it is really popular in Boston. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, it is almost certain that the Samuel Parris, who's then the minister of Salem Village, would have had this book, would have read it, maybe would have talked about it to his children, who then would have gotten the, would have known that this was a thing that children, that could happen to children, you know, that you can be afflicted by witches and it looks a certain way and it has a certain effect. And the ripple effect of story is basically, is one of the things about Salem that most interests me, and which I, you know, talk about a lot in the book, and the ways in which the narratives that we engage with and the stories that we start to tell about people and about our world can really take on a life of their own and almost become reality in ways we really didn't expect.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Alice Markham Cantor to discuss her book, The Once and Future Witch Hunt. Alice and I discuss her ancestor, Martha Carrier, who was hanged as a witch in Salem, along with my ancestor, Cotton Mather, who contributed to the hanging. We discuss Salem as a story about stories, an emerging capitalism as the backdrop of the witch hunts, and how Salem was an inversion of power relationships. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Alice Markham Cantor is a fact checker whose work has been published in New York Magazine, Scientific American, The Nation, and elsewhere. She serves on the working committee of the International Network Against Accusations of Witchcraft and Associated Harmful Practices, and she spoke at the first and second feminist conferences on the witch hunts. Alice is the writer and co-producer of A Witch Story, an award-winning documentary about Salem and her research. She joins me today to discuss her book, The Once and Future Witch Hunt. Alice, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thanks so much, Nick.
Well, I am so excited to speak with you. I have already mentioned this to you, but I absolutely loved your book. I read a lot of books for this podcast, and I usually enjoy most of them, but every now and then one just kind of stands out. And I know it's early in the year, but your book is going to be hard to beat as one of my favorites, I think, for this
year. Thank you so much.
Yeah, so congratulations on it. When is it going to be? It hasn't been released quite yet, has it?
Not quite yet. It'll be out actually a month from tomorrow, so May 8th. It'll be out, but you can pre-order it now and everything.
Okay. Yeah. This will be out a little bit after that. So it'll be widely available when people are see this. So there are a lot of different ways to kind of approach this. And I think that the main focus for you was you are a descendant of one of the women hanged as a witch. And this was Martha Carrier. And so I thought maybe we should begin with Martha and her
She's
story.
The starting spot.
Yeah. And what you uncovered about her and who she was.
Great place to start. You know, she is the progenitor of all of this, literally, for me. So Martha Carrier was hanged in the Salem witch trials. But before that, she was the daughter of a couple in Andover, Massachusetts. She's born in around 1650. We don't have the exact birth date, but it's around then because she's around 40 years old, 1650, 1652. She's around 40 years old when she is hanged for witchcraft. She, at the time of her death, has five children. She's married, and she and her husband, for most of their life, for most of their marriage, have lived in the town of Balearica, which is nearby to Andover, where they were farmers, so they're sort of just living a relatively regular Puritan life, except for a few things which would go on to make Martha vulnerable to witchcraft accusation. So the first major thing in Martha's life that sort of makes her, that sets the ground to draw her into the witch trials, that when she marries her husband, she is 7 months pregnant with their first child, which, and she, this is all very public. You know, Puritan Massachusetts was very, very hard to keep any real secrets. Everything was everybody else's business. They have a real sort of surveillance age mentality going on. And so this is a very well-known thing. So she is sort of known as, you know, someone who has broken Puritan norms, Puritan values to start. And then we're going to fast forward about 15 years. And when just a few years before the trials, in the end of the 1680s, Martha and her family move from Billerica back to Andover. I say move, it's like 3 miles. It's like, a, you know, not a very far distance. But they move back in with Martha's parents. The timing here is very bad because right after they arrive, there is an outbreak of smallpox. And the outbreak eventually is traced that it started in Boston and is sort of going across the colony. But so when Martha and her family arrive and then there's a smallpox epidemic, they will eventually be blamed for the smallpox epidemic, the outbreak. The town authorities sort of say, like, you know, you may have brought this, and we're not going to, you know, supply any aid to you and your family because you've done this. And Martha's 13 people die in Andover of smallpox that winter. And almost all of them are related to Martha in one way or another. Her mother dies, her father dies, both her brothers die. And this creates a little bit of a problem because with the death of both of Martha's father and both her brothers, she only has sisters left. And so it puts her in a position where she might be able to inherit the family farm, her father's land. Which is, you know, it's just not a great look if you show up and then lots of people die of smallpox and then maybe you stand to materially gain from it. This is the kind of thing that in the, you know, a time of peace is, so it goes, that's just, it's bad luck. But in a time of fear and during a witch hunt, that kind of thing can be remembered and then used as a way to intimate that somebody might be a witch. So all these things contribute to making Martha a vulnerable target for witchcraft accusation. But maybe the single most important thing is her personality, which we know from the trial records is a little bit strong-willed, shall we say. She's a real character. She is like, when she thinks a neighbor is farming too close to her land, she will go and yell at him directly and curse him out and like make it everybody's problem. When a girl is being disruptive in church, she's going to curse out this 12-year-old girl. You know, it's like she was not a conciliatory person. She was not a submissive personality. She was a very sort of stringent, powerful personality, which of course also transgresses Puritan expectations of femininity and what a woman's place should be. How that sort of womanhood should be expressed. And she was very much not doing that.
And I know that you wrote that there's limited information about Martha and who she was. And that's one of the things I loved about your book is that you flesh it out and you make her a real person that the reader could relate to and kind of stand up for her. And I almost found myself almost getting teary-eyed towards the very end. And then my relative comes in and ruins everything.
I honestly have a weird affection for affection is maybe not quite the right word, but he plays such a role in the story. And I spent so much time thinking about him also. I'm like, whoa. But we'll get to that in a second. I think I definitely, it was important to me when I was writing that she feel real to people.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, Salem is a unique event in that we do have a lot of records. We have some of the transcripts of preliminary hearings, of court records. We have all of these accusations and depositions and indictments and warrants that were filed with the legal documents. We're also missing a lot of legal documents, but that's its own thing. But specifically for the women who are involved, we don't have we don't really have any evidence that would point to their interiority. Like, what are they thinking in this moment? We only have the things they said out loud to other people. And so we have to extrapolate and sort of build back from that into the silences in the record to think about what was here. Like, what would lead somebody to become the kind of person who would say this,
right,
and who would do these actions? So we're sort of starting at the end and extrapolating backward. And it was definitely a real challenge, because I mentioned this early on in the book, but for Martha's direct words, like words that we know that she said, not accusations, not things other people said about her, but things she said, we've got about 3 pages.
Wow.
It's very little. It's like mostly just from her preliminary hearing, which was the chance when you can plead innocent or guilty. And that's when we have her direct dialogue, one might say. And so you have to sort of, I spent a lot of time with those words specifically. And of course, you know, that's a limited window, but I tried to, I was like, okay, this is her voice. You start there. And then I sort of zoom out to try and get the rest of her.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you learn that one of your ancestors was part of the witch trials?
I found out for the first time when I was 13 years old. And I say for the first time, because it was a little bit of a two-part thing, where when I was 13, my uncle did some genealogy research and sort of sent us all a very casual email to say, hey, you know, we're descended from this woman who was killed in Salem. And we were all like, oh, that's cool. And sort of, it went right over our heads. Like, there was not a real engagement with this, which I think is fairly common, right? There are a huge number of Salem descendants walking around. Right. We're two of them, but there's so many. And most people do not sort of get hooked in a specific way. They might be interested, but you know, life's busy, things happen. And then the following year, when I was 14, I was visiting my brother at college and wandering through the school library. And I went over to this book on a shelf, and I don't know, like, you know, I write about this in the book, but I don't remember like what drew me to this book, but I pulled it down and it was a book about Salem, and I opened it and there was her name. And I had this moment of recognition and this moment of, I remember this name, I know this name. And that was what sort of hooked me. And then I was embarking on then the light research started, and then we just got deeper and deeper.
Right. Yeah. It's incredibly well researched. And I think that maybe before we go any further, I think this is important, is to define a witch.
Totally. So there's a section of the book where I talk about, like, what is a witch in this story? And I rewrote that section many times to try and sort of really pare it down, because a witch is, there are so many different definitions for a witch, and there are so many different frameworks that people are, you know, different that people are working in when they try to define a witch. So I come to this from sort of an anthropological perspective, where what I'm really interested in is the role of the witch. Like, what does it do to someone to be accused of witchcraft? What does it do to a community to accuse someone? And what's that relationship? So for me, and in this book, I define a witch as a person who is believed by their community to have access to some kind of power, to some kind of, you know, systems of information, systems of knowledge, systems of power that most people in the community do not have access to. That's really important, right? Like, they have something that other people do not. And for me, and for this story, based on the way that the witch role has been used in witch hunts, a witch is someone who is going to use that power for harm, for evil. They are a danger in some way to the functioning of the community, to the integrity of the community. And so a witch then has to be eradicated, right? They're sort of fundamentally other.
Right.
And for me, the witch role really functions as like a community repository of fear, because it is an inherently relational role. Right. You can't have a witch of this kind without having an accuser. Because this kind of witch is not the kind where you're saying, oh, I'm, you know, you're not self-identifying as a witch. This is the kind of witch where someone else has said, you are a witch, and I am making that distinction by separating, making distance between us.
Right.
By to call someone as a witch is to say that you are not a witch yourself.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it was an interesting question because I think that in the popular imagination, we have these ideas of witches that often are kind of connected to like a goddess culture or something.
Totally.
And I read last summer, I think it was, is it Ronald Sutton or Hutton? Ronald Hutton, I
Hutton.
think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. His
Yeah.
book, The Witch. And he has a very similar sort of definition there. So it's not someone who's
Yeah.
identifying,
I
you
love
know.
he's that's a great book. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. He does some really good work. And I that's one of the things that
Yeah.
I had noted here is that the witch is the other. You know, and it exists, she they exist
Right.
in
There's sort of a
relationship.
fundamental. Totally. And I think that, you know, it's a really interesting point to think about the history of the word witch and the history of sort of how witch is conceptualized. Because I think what, you know, what Ronald Hutton is doing in his book, The Witch, which is excellent, I highly recommend. And what I'm engaging with here is the sort of historical fact of, you know, for much of human culture, across cultures, we've had these ideas of people who can access certain systems of power that the rest of us don't, and that people, they might use that power for harm. And that's very, very different than the modern conception of witch as a spirituality, of Wicca, of paganism, of any of that, as sort of like a witch is, it's, so it's just a very separate lineage of thought in a way, right? Where, and they certainly draw overlap and they draw their many like connections of thought that have been drawn, but they are the thing that I keep going back to is the fact that what I really study is witch hunts. And for most of human history, witch hunts do not target people who self-identify as witches. They really don't. They also don't even target people who are necessarily doing things that we would understand today as quote unquote witchy, right? Like they're not necessarily targeting people who are engaging with goddess culture or having alternative spiritualities, but are really, witch hunts really operate on sort of a different, fundamentally political paradigm.
Right.
And I think that that is, it's a tricky thing to talk about because the word is so, like when people think of witch hunts, they think of witchcraft.
Right.
And sometimes those may be related and sometimes they're not at all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I do want to get into some of the bits about Salem itself and those trials. But is it fair to say that what happened in Salem was part of a larger witch hunt? And I don't want to say craze, because I think that you suggest, you know, it's not really a craze. It's not really an hysteria, but that something that began in Europe.
Totally. I think 100. I think that's a great question. And it's actually really important to place Salem at the end of sort of a much longer period of witch hunting in England, in Europe, in Western Europe. That Salem is fundamentally a British colony at this point in time, right? And so they've inherited both British law, which allows for and sometimes requires witch hunting. And then they make their own law, which also, because it's explicitly biblical, also requires witch hunting. But throughout, so starting at the end of the 1400s, there is a real increase in accusations of witchcraft being brought to both religious and secular courts, and then creating actual trials and creating what we think of as witch, like the witch hunts, you know, the witch burnings, all of this. They really don't happen in the medieval period, which is a common misconception. People are like, oh yeah, in the, you know, 1100s, probably Middle Ages, that's when witch hunting was happening. Not so much. There might have been, you know, there are a few scattered here and there, but there's not really this kind of large scale like witch burning until end of the 14, really 15, 1600s. And the hot spot often is thought of as like the end of the 1500s to the middle of the 1600s, which is the Renaissance. And is also a period of time in which Europe is undergoing immense political and economic changes. It's the beginning of colonization. You have a total upheaval of Europe's economic system with new money flowing in from the colonies. And so it's this real, all of that contributes to the system of witch hunting that's happening in Europe. And this witch hunts sort of start to decline in some places across the 1600s, although they'll continue in, you know, in parts of England, in Scotland, in Germany, into the 1700s. But Salem really is best understood as part of this overarching wave. And Salem also wasn't the only witch hunt in New England.
Right.
There were a few smaller witch hunts, sort of witch outbreaks of witchcraft accusation, and then trials and hangings starting in around 1648 in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And Salem has its sort of special place in American history, I think, not because it was the only witch hunt, but it is the biggest one in Puritan Massachusetts for sure. And it's also the last major American witch hunt where that is like, where the legality is taken really seriously. But I also think Salem is really unusual because it's one of the only witch hunts where the accusers apologize, right, not that long after the trials themselves, which is like unheard of for witch hunts. That doesn't, that almost never happens. Yeah. So Salem has a lot, going on.
Yeah. My understanding was always that what kind of preceded what happened in Salem was an event in Boston, that there were
the Goody Glover.
Yeah. And that's where Cotton Mather kind of comes in, because he had some of the afflicted in his house and wrote about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happens in Boston, this is Boston in 1688-89, end of the year, an old Irish washerwoman named Goody Glover is accused of witchcraft by her former employer, whose children have started to suffer these inexplicable afflictions. And Goody Glover is hanged eventually, and this is also, there's some interesting thought around, how much of this is anti-Catholic sentiment as well, because she was an Irish Catholic. She potentially maybe like shouts in Gaelic or Latin,
right,
which people are like, what are you doing? That's definitely witchcraft. But exactly. So the children get taken in by Cotton, who is at this point one of the sort of, he's a young, aspiring, like really on the up and up minister.
Yeah.
And he then writes a book about what their afflictions looked like, his recommendations on how to cure them from a minister's point of view. And I think this is super, super important, where it starts what is sort of the fundamental ripple effect of Salem, which is narrative, which is one of the big things that I play with in the book, which is the fact that he writes this book, and it is really popular in Boston. Mm-hmm. And it is almost certain that the Samuel Parris, who is then the minister of Salem Village, would have had this book, would have read it, maybe would have talked about it to his children, who then would have known that this was a thing that could happen to children, that you can be afflicted by witches and it looks a certain way and it has a certain effect. And the ripple effect of story is basically one of the things about Salem that most interests me, and which I, talk about a lot in the book, and the ways in which the narratives that we engage with and the stories that we start to tell about people and about our world can really take on a life of their own and almost become reality in ways we really didn't expect.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the things I've written down here from your book, is that you wrote, Salem is a story about stories. The rest of the quote here is, how they're created, whose are believed, how a good one can peel itself off the page or the tongue and float up into the world, and if caught by the right wind, travel great distances.
That's basically specifically with Cotton, right? So he writes, also very funny, I'm always referring to these like men who have been dead for 300 years by their first names only. So if you want me to remember who I'm talking about, just let me know.
Yeah.
So Cotton Mather, right, part of what he writes about as well, remember, is also a witch hunt that recently, or an outbreak of witchcraft accusation and ensuing hunt in Norway. He also has a whole treatise writing about this, which that hunt looks pretty similar to Salem. It starts with some young children having afflictions, and then accusing people. And it's a bigger hunt than Salem's, actually, they end up. But it's like, okay, so he hears this story and he writes it down. And he's then thinking about this story of what happened in Norway when Goody Glover in Boston happens and when he starts to see these children be afflicted. And then all of this gets written into, the stories reinforce each other and they repeat themselves. And then he writes a new book that then plays into how Salem plays out.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, the ways that the stories sort of reinforce and pile on. But then also with what I was getting at in that, with the quote that you read as well, is that fundamentally what Salem is people telling stories about each other within a yeah. community. Right, it's someone saying, what is an accusation of witchcraft? It's someone saying, here is a story about you that I am telling and I'm going to make the court believe. Because fundamentally, accusations of witchcraft in Salem were not true. So there are sort of these narratives that people are crafting and may have totally believed. You know, I think that some of the people who were, I think many of the people making accusations, I don't mean to say that they were just sort of willfully making up stories, but there's a real, Salem really plays havoc with right. our definitions of truth and false, mm-hmm. of truth and falsehoods, where it's those definitions sometimes almost feel useless. It's right. like what's less important is what is true than what was believed and what power that belief has to mm-hmm. create real change in the world, which is a thought.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know, you know, everyone knows, you know, they've heard of Salem. And I don't know how much of the details they know, but it was what, like 150 some people were accused of witchcraft.
Yeah, well, there were 150 arrested even. Yeah.
And you know, Cotton Mather's mother was accused of witchcraft.
Yeah. And the mother of John Hathorne, who's one of the magistrates, one of the main magistrates, she gets accused of witchcraft. And he's just like, yeah, we're going to ignore that one. Like, don't worry about it. There's real selectivity.
Yeah.
You know, on the part of the judges and the sort of the law enforcement mechanism of who they're going to, whose accusations they're going to take seriously, which goes back to, you know, it's a story of whose words are believed.
Right.
What kind of story do you have to tell to have power? What kind of story do you have to tell for your words and your voice to matter?
Yeah.
Which is also really important because the main accusers in Salem, when it starts and throughout much of it, are these young girls, this group of teenage girls, you know, ages 11 to like 20, 21, who in normal circumstances would have almost no power of, you know, they could not say something that would just be believed. And Salem turns that on its head. And suddenly they can say something that will contradict almost anyone, not anyone, but almost anyone's word and be believed.
Yeah.
And that is it's an inversion of the expected power relationships. But what's also really important is that they then sort of use that opening to climb and sort of try and increase some of their power. But it's whose stories are believed, which is also when we think about Tituba, who has become very famous as sort of a quintessential Salem witch, who is also in the, she has a unique moment in Salem where she is enslaved in the minister's house and is like, you know, the bottom of the order of social power. And when she is accused and then confesses, her words are given unprecedented authority. They are suddenly these people who in every other case would disbelieve and devalue anything Tituba says, they're hanging on her every word. They're believing everything. And that's also a total inversion of power, which is not like, it's not a sort of, it's a power that comes to Tituba at enormous cost. Like she's been accused of witchcraft, but it is this inversion of whose stories normally have power and are believed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a key point in the book is about power. And especially the, you know, Tituba, you know, she vanishes from the records, but the girls who are, you know, the afflicted, they're aligning themselves with power. And you quoted kind of in detail, you go into the work by Sylvia Federici, Caliban and the Witches. And thank you for that, because that's been on my Amazon wish list for a couple of years. I just moved it up to the top.
Oh, incredible.
But it is that places it, you know, both Salem and what's going on in Europe with the enclosure of the commons. And I found that particularly interesting because the enclosure of the commons is also a main theme that runs through a lot of environmental thinking. And right. So I've been trying to like join together somehow the what's going on, you know, ecologically, environmentally, and the witch trials themselves. But it is, like you said, you know, the Goody Glover, she was poor. And the first one accused in Salem was destitute.
Right. And this is a crucial part. Yeah, I'm first of all so glad that you're going to read Caliban. Highly recommend if you want to know more about the, you know, for anybody who wants to know more about the great witch hunts of Europe and sort of this major period of witch hunting. Because what Federici writes about, which he does really, really well, is engaging with the emergence of capitalism as a system that is totally changing the way that Europeans live in this moment, and so the way that the colonies are operating. And it is, we have a pattern that plays out a lot in witchcraft accusations, where the first person to be accused will be almost always poor. You know, rich people don't really get, they might get accused of witchcraft, they're not really going to die from it. You know, like it's the people who are killed in witch hunts are overwhelmingly poor. That's, and it's not just that they get killed because they don't have social power because they're poor, but it also plays into why they were accused. Right. In the first place. So what you're saying with the enclosure of the commons, what happens in Europe at this period in time is that there's enclosure is this process by which what were previously commonly held lands or lands that sort of that weren't under one person's ownership, but could be used as, you know, everyone's hunting in the forest or they have different kinds of fishing rights in a stream, or there's common pasture land for grazing. It's the centuries long process of bringing almost all of that land under discrete individual owners, which means that plenty of people are losing access to it, and plenty of people as a result are becoming impoverished and often having to leave where they used to live, and they're wandering around and they're destitute. And it's paired with a whole wage crisis in Europe as well. And some of the people hit hardest were older women who didn't have a family or a husband to support them. And these women were often reduced to begging, you know, house to house for charity, and become prime targets for witchcraft accusations. Because so Sarah Good in Salem is a great example of this, where Sarah Good was born rich, loses a lot, you know, money through a variety of factors, becomes poor, and she goes around and is asking for charity from her neighbors. And if she is refused, and then she, you know, says something, she's like, well, screw you for refusing me. And then the person who she refused, their cow dies. That could be seen as Sarah Good put a spell on my cow to die. And it's this really interesting social mechanism that plays into, you know, some of the guilt that people feel for withholding charity from withholding things that they could give and that would really improve somebody else's life, but they're not going to do it. It's also, it has to do with the changing vision of Christianity at this moment, and like, what is your moral responsibility to your fellow citizens? Right. Is this the church's responsibility? Is it your responsibility? Is it the king's responsibility? People aren't totally sure yet, and there's this whole debate. And then there's the, you know, the Puritans are also a little bit unsure. Do people deserve to be poor? Do they deserve to be rich? Like, how does being rich play into my vision of your morality?
Right.
And all of this combines to make poor people, poor women, especially like Sarah Good, especially vulnerable to accusations of witchcraft.
And I don't think that you mentioned this in the book, but as you were speaking, you know, it seems another source that's really relevant to this is the work of Max Weber about the Protestant ethic and capitalism, you know?
100%. I was trying not to quote too much Weber in the book, but I think it's related. Like, it's absolutely related. It is the fact that the Puritans are developing this idea in the moment in which Salem is taking place. They're developing this idea that to be wealthy means has some sort of reflection on your moral fortitude, your relationship to, you know, are you, it means you're a good person, But of course, the inverse of that is that if you are not wealthy, it's probably because you deserve it. And over time, of course, in America, that sort of filtered, it lost the Puritan trappings and became a secular thought process, which we still absolutely engage with on all levels of policy, you know, thinking that people who are poor sort of achieved this through their own fault of character somehow, not working hard enough, not taking advantage of opportunities, as opposed to seeing it potentially as a systemic issue.
Right. Yeah. That's always there. And when I cover this in classes, that's what I always tell students. I'm like, just listen and you'll still hear it. You'll still hear that Puritan ethic there.
It's hanging out. The Puritans really made such an impact on our culture.
Yeah. And but what's so interesting is that the trials themselves, it was 1692, right? This was sort of the end of the Puritan era, because it wasn't so much longer, like 20, 25 years later, that you get, I think it was Jonathan Edwards, who's that sort of that bridge character in between the Puritanism and this sort of evangelicalism that becomes dominant in the U.S. So I wonder if the witch trials themselves, you know, had an effect on the demise of Puritanism?
I mean, I think it's a great question. I can't prove it, but personally, I think they probably did in terms of the way that people talk about the witch trials over the next century. Yeah. So, you know, by less than 100 years after the trials in the 1770s, John Adams is writing about the trials and calling them a stain upon the history of this country. They're already seen as this, you know, this thing that people really don't want to be associated with. And they were so fundamentally Puritan that I would imagine, you know, I would imagine that people really did sort of see like a connection there. I also think, that they sort of would end up discrediting the very thing that they had been employed to protect. Yeah. I also think that what something else that's happening right when the trials are taking place is the whole business with the Puritan Charter, which we don't have to go into too crazily for a history lesson, but basically the Puritans for most of the time in the colony had operated with a certain Puritan Charter that was the document from the king that gave them permission to, you know, make laws, have courts, do their thing in the New World and have control over that territory in the eyes of the British Empire. When just, you know, 10 years before the trials, about that charter is revoked because the Puritans have been disobeying the king in a variety of ways. And so he's like, no, you don't get to just do whatever you want anymore. One thing that the charter did is it let the Puritans create a state that was inherent, that was a Puritan supremacist state, right? Like they could make laws if they wanted to, saying that only Puritans can do certain things. They could discriminate against Baptists or Quakers, which they absolutely did. They hated the Quakers. And so they could sort of have their religious power be reinforced by law. And literally, while the trials are taking place, a new charter is arriving from England. Mm. And this new charter does not have that provision. It actually says that the Puritans can't discriminate against any other kinds of Christians except Catholics. You can still discriminate against Catholics, but nobody else. Which was, you know, a very tolerant idea for this time. They're like, but no, you know, you can't discriminate against Anglicans. You can't discriminate against Baptists. You can't. So, and, you know, for the Puritans, this is that's a real shift. That's a real shift. You know, Cotton Mather and his father Increase, who helps negotiate for this charter, are trying to sell this as an okay thing. You know, it's going to be good for us in the long run to have a new relationship with England. They're focusing on all this stuff. But what that charter fundamentally does is it really puts a spoke in the wheel of Puritan supremacy and in the whole Puritan project in the New World, which was to create a Puritan state, effectively. They weren't using those exact words, but it was to create a certain kind of Christian state. And they're no longer going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
And so I think that while the trials did not cause the charter switch, obviously, I do think that the charter reinforced some of the fear around the trials. But I also think that it's those two things are happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so you're totally right with your question, just to see the sort of loss of Puritan supremacy, the loss of the end of Puritanism, and the trials as linked.
Well, you noted, I was just looking here in my notes, there was one person who was accused that you wrote that if anyone was a witch, you were hoping it was him. And that was William Barker, because he was antithetical to this sort of Puritan theocracy that they were hoping to build, where, you know, he rejected a lot of Christian dogma of like the end of days and, you know, no punishment for sin, get rid of shame, religious tolerance, equality.
Crazy. Yeah. So he gives this amazing confession, which where he is like, yes, so we are here to tear down all the governments of New England. You know, you were starting to get worried that maybe the witches were here to do a political coup to, like, they're over the course of the witch trials, this idea emerges that the witches aren't here to just, you know, afflict the girls. They're not here to just cause problems in Salem Village. They're actually here to quote Cotton Mather, to tear down that happy settlement of government, where, you know, they're here to get rid of the government and the churches of New England, to destroy Puritanism. And that is a really interesting idea, because that frames the witch hunt as, in effect, an anti-revolutionary, a reactionary endeavor, where they see the witch hunts at they see the witches as like instigators, saboteurs, they're revolutionaries under the thumb of the devil, you know, in order to bring about Satan's kingdom in the New World. But Barker, William Barker, this guy who gives this confession, is the only one who sort of gives us a real idea of, like, you know, what might the Puritans have been the most afraid of to see? Because this is the idea that he is suggesting maybe the witches would be going for. And you have to imagine that he is suggesting that because he knows it's the thing that the Puritans are, you know, you're saying the thing that sounds the worst. And what he says is that the devil's kingdom will be a place where there is equality for all. So let's start there. It'll be a place where there's no punishment for shame or sin, which is totally antithetical to Puritanism, which believed in a lot of punishment and shaming for sin, and that, you know, everyone will sort of, there will be no social stratification. There will be a totally different kind of world. And I think about that confession a lot, and the idea that both, like, this is what the Puritans were most afraid of sort of an egalitarian, almost anarchist, atheist world. This is their vision of what they are most afraid of happening in Massachusetts.
And it came to be. We're just celebrating the devil's kingdom, I suppose.
Okay. We're just celebrating. Yeah, you know, we're just saying, I think, you know, it's like the American project, our devil's kingdom project is incomplete, but it is a, you know, sort of fundamentalist, fundamentally anarchist, anti-social stratification, egalitarian project. And I can get behind that.
So let's talk just a little bit about, because I know we're getting close to the end here, but about the causes of the trials, because we've talked about a couple of different things, you know, this, you know, emerging capitalism and colonialism. And it seems to me that there's no real steady answer, but that it's probably several things that came into play all at once. The thing that I normally say is that it's a lot of petty grievances.
Totally. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's no, you know, we like to really hope that there will be sort of one easy, clean answer for why this happened. And there's not. So sorry. But there are a lot of interlocking factors that we can look at and that all play a role. One of these is that what I've been talking about, the overarching political and economic shifts that are happening. And one is petty grievances. You know, the Salem witch trials happen in Salem Village for a reason. And it's because they have a really, the social fabric of that village was fraying. They were having a really hard time interpersonally, and they're having a clash that over their church, over the church dogma, over the minister, over, you know, people are having clashes about land within the town, but there's all of these petty grievances that people have with each other that spill out over the course of the trials. And it's, you know, it's impossible to tell who is accusing someone because they just want revenge, and who is accusing someone because, well, you know, we've been having a land dispute for years. And so obviously, if something bad happens in my life and I'm looking for the witch who did it, I'm going to look at the person who I know is mad at me. And it's that person who I did the land dispute with.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like there's a way in which all of these grievances can cause witchcraft accusations along those same lines, even without it being sort of a conscious, like, I'm going to accuse you as revenge. But it absolutely, it's all of these little grievances spilling out. It's, and it, you know, there are certainly people in Salem who did more than others, like the Putnam family, who I write a lot about in this, who have just, are responsible for way more than their share of the accusations. They file an incredible number of accusations and of evidence for those accusations.
Like, wasn't it like 120 or 130?
Yeah, it's like an unbelievable amount. It's like of the existing things, it's something like, it's something like a third of all the existing papers were filed. And it's like, that's unbelievable, right? Like it was this one family that was really, they had a lot of grievances, and they understood, especially the patriarch of this family, Thomas Putnam, who's the one writing all of these depositions out on behalf of his daughter and his maid and his wife and his cousin, you know, I think it was really sort of understood as like, he liked the trials. He understood them as a beneficial thing by which he was going to sort of stop the deterioration of Salem Village, seems to be what his letters indicate, that like he would have. Really important to remember that a witch hunt is likely to, if people like a benefit of it, makes them feel safer. It makes them feel like they have control. And also a material benefit, because definitely a lot of the people who he was accusing, he'd had some kind of dispute with. But
One of the things that I found really fascinating that I had never actually thought about before is you noted that, again, this is another direct quote, what made someone worth killing in Salem in 1692 was not the practice of witchcraft. It was the refusal to believe that you were one. And that's what got Martha.
That's what got Martha. Totally. It's, So the people who are executed in Salem are all people who go to the gallows saying, I'm not a witch.
Right.
Which is very unusual, actually, for a witch hunt as well, partially because you would torture people into confessing. But what makes Salem weird is that you have plenty of people in Salem who have confessed and who say, yes, I am a witch, and I did do this, and are not killed. And there's some indication that the court planned to kill them later, but they're not the court's priority.
Right.
The court's priority are these people who refuse to say that they're a witch, to refuse to confess, refuse to believe, to fundamentally, we're back to stories, we're back to narrative, who fundamentally refuse to believe the story the court has told them about themselves. And so it opens these questions of like, do you know who you are? And are you willing to sort of subsume yourself to the story someone else is telling about you? Or are you going to refuse to take part in that narrative and set up your own? And there's one person in Salem who confesses, but then recants and is killed. So he fits into it still, where he's, everyone else doesn't even ever confess. One guy confesses, then later he's like, I'm wrong, I took that back. And suddenly the court is like, oh, okay, you're back on our shit list. Like, now we're going to kill you.
Wow.
And I think that this is, it really feels super important to me to understand Salem, that it is, you know, partially the judges are pursuing these people because they are the ones who are understood to be unrepentant. They're the ones who are understood to, you know, someone could have done some witchcraft, but now they feel bad about it. They've confessed, they've apologized, they're helping the court. They've turned against Satan, you know, and they're giving the names of other witches fundamentally. But if you refuse to do that, you are fundamentally someone who is not, you are not on the side of the court. You are not on the side of the church. That's how they see you, that you are fundamentally othering yourself now and marking yourself as a non-believer, which is one of the worst things a Puritan could be. The people who are, what made a witch worth killing in Salem is the refusal to admit to witchcraft, which is in effect the refusal to believe that you are a witch.
Right. Why do you think Salem still holds on to American imagination?
Great question. I think that Salem has us in this chokehold for a couple reasons. I think, first of all, it's one of America's origin stories in a way, where it's one of, the very early things that we all sort of that like you hear about in elementary or middle school, and it becomes just sort of like there are frankly, we don't get taught a lot about like anything that happened in the American colonies before the Revolutionary War. And so it's usually like maybe the French and Indian War, probably just Salem. And so it sort of has this like, it almost to me sometimes feels like before the 1619 Project entered schools, it sort of felt to me like American history like starts with Salem for a lot of people. But I think that it sort of fundamentally has this grab on us because Salem's question is fundamentally, what would you have done? Because it's asking us, how could this have happened? And we really want to know, because what's buried in that fear of the how could the Salem witch trials have happened is the fear of what's to keep this from happening again. What's to keep this from happening to us today? And the answer, frankly, is very little. And I think what people, I mean, that, we can mention the fact now, as I always do, that witch hunts do still happen around the world every week. That people are still harmed and killed after being accused of witchcraft by people who they know. And so this is still actually very much an ongoing problem. We sort of treat Salem like it's the end of the story, when in fact it's one bead on a very long string. And so we're certainly not done with witch hunts yet. We're not over. That's not a thing of the past. But I also think that Salem grabs us because, it we all Arthur Miller called it the crucible for a reason. I think about, a crucible is where you melt down the materials and you see what the component parts are. You fundamentally see what it's made of. Salem is where you see what you're made of, where you see, okay, if I'm accused, and if I am given the choice of confess and name other people as witches and potentially save my life, or refuse to confess to a crime I didn't commit, something I know that I didn't do, and be killed as a result, and refuse to name other people and throw them under the bus instead, what do you do? Like, when it comes down to it, do you decide to sacrifice yourself in order to sort of both stay true to your principles and not kill someone else? Or do you sacrifice someone else to buy your own life? It's a big question. And it is it's very hard to answer until you do it.
But yeah, and I think that this idea that witch hunts are still happening, it's shocking because the average was almost like two people a day back
Yeah,
in the day.
it's a way more than we hear about in this country. It is, the best data that we have right now, which is almost certainly an undercount, is like 1,000 people per year are harmed or killed in witch hunts every year, which is a lot, frankly, for witch hunts. It's a small number of people in the overall population, but it's a lot. And it's especially a lot in terms of it's the problem that many people sort of don't know is happening, don't think exists. But there's a lot of, work being done in places where witch hunts are common, and organizing that people are doing to try and stop them. And
It's fascinating. And it seems to me that one of the other things that's at play is this notion of there was this element of irrationality in Salem, especially with the idea of spectral evidence, that was admissible. And I think there's always this fear that we will give in to irrationality again.
I think there's a really interesting conversation to be had that would probably take more time than we have left about some of the relationship, the echoes that we see today in some sorts of conspiracy theories and witch hunts and spectral evidence, and the idea that the less you can see something, the
More
more
true.
true it is, right? Which is a big part of conspiracy theory logic, where it's, yes, of course, the reason that you can't see this playing out, the reason you can't see the cabal or something, is because they're in charge. Which, like, wait a second, that's spectral evidence logic, where the less that you can see the yellow bird flying around that woman's head, the more she's a witch, because someone else can see it and they're telling you it's true. And so it teaches you, it's this logic that teaches you to distrust your own, both like your own thought and other people's thoughts, and actually limit your, who you see as an authority to very specific people.
Wow. Yeah, that is a fascinating connection. And I know we're out of time, so unfortunately we can't really dig into that.
Can't dive in, but next time.
Maybe some other time. Maybe some other time, because I've very much enjoyed this. And there's so many different places to go in terms of Salem, because it keeps telling the story, you know?
Yeah. It's the end. It's the story that truly keeps on
right.
giving.
Right. So let me ask you the two final questions that I always ask. One is, what do you have coming up next? What are you working on next?
Ooh, well, so the book is coming out. So that's sort of what I'm doing right now. There's a conference that I'm looking forward to this fall in England at the University of Lancaster that's going to be about, like, how do we, didn't we have witch hunting around the world today? And, like, what can we learn about and create best practices of, like, how to help people stop witch hunts. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I do have some ideas for a next book. I can't promise it'll be about witch hunting, but we'll see. Well, this has a way of sneaking into everything I think about.
Okay, that's fair. And do you have a website? Do you have a place where people can go to find out more about you and keep up to date with what you're doing?
Yes, they can visit alicemarkhamcantor.com. So just my first and last name, no hyphen, no period, nothing. And there's a contact form on my website that where people can get in touch with me.
Okay.
And I'll have updates there. I have a couple articles coming out, one that will be diving more into how Salem got started, really just like how the witch hunts began in sort of a shorter form that I'll be posting there so people can look at that.
All right. Wonderful. Well, I'll put a link for your website and also links for the book in the show notes in the video description. And once again, I highly recommend anyone who has even a passing interest in Salem to pick up your book. It was a very enjoyable read and it's very well written and just engaging. And it brings it to life, I think, in a way that other Salem books do not. So
thank you so much. That's so kind of you. And I'm so glad that you enjoyed it.
Oh, I did. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So, all right. Well, Alice, thank you. It's been a joy speaking with you.
You too.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 135 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends, family members, coworkers, and please share it on social media too. And subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing, all of that is really important. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always say, I'm here in the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.